Tropical Storm Isaac has delayed NASA's effort to launch a pair of satellites to Earth's radiation belts. On board, instruments created by University of Iowa researchers to study space weather. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. NASA will try again later this week to launch the satellites. In the first half hour today, we'll talk with University of Iowa astronomy professor Craig Kletzing, who was in Florida. He'll tell us about the instruments created by UI researchers that are part of the mission. Then the director of the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication, David Perlmutter. This summer, he led an Iowa delegation to Turkey to study their culture and media. That's all coming up this hour. First, the news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. NASA's effort to launch a pair of satellites to Earth's radiation belts has been delayed until later this week, hopefully, because of Tropical Storm Isaac. It was in the wee hours of Saturday. The countdown was halted at the four-minute mark for the second time in as many days. Thunderstorms prevented the unmanned rocket from blasting off with NASA's radiation belt storm probes. A day earlier on Friday, during the first attempt, a tracking beacon on the rocket held up the flight. Initially, NASA said it would try again on Sunday, but with Isaac barreling toward Florida, launch managers decided to move the Atlas V rocket back into its hangar. Sit tight until this storm passes. They are now aiming for a Thursday launch. On board that rocket, that Atlas V, twin satellites designed to study Earth's Van Allen radiation belts. They include instruments created by University of Iowa researchers to study space weather. Joining us now to explain a little bit about this project, University of Iowa physics and astronomy professor Craig Kletzing. Welcome to our studio.
Thank you.
You were down in Florida for these two failed launches. That must have been very disappointing.
Well, it's disappointing not to get it off when you want, but on the other hand, you want to make sure that everything is completely right when you launch, because it's a complicated business launching things into space, and you don't go unless everything is exactly how it should be.
Mm-hmm. Where are you for the launch?
Well, for these first two attempts, we were actually on the fifth floor of a building that's about 4 miles away from the launch site, so we had a nice clear view. For the next try here, we'll actually just have to go out to the causeway, where you're a little further away, but you can still see quite well. They only do a couple of attempts of bringing a whole big crowd in to see things.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit more about why these launches were called off?
Well, as you noted, the first one was due to a tracking beacon, and that's part of the safety system for the rocket. And safety really comes first. And so without that properly functioning, we got down to the last 4 minutes, and we got a no-go on that particular system, and so that was the end of it. The second night, I think people were hopeful. It looked like the weather might hold up, but then things started to deteriorate about an hour before launch. And when the rocket goes up, it can actually trigger lightning. And so that was the big concern, because you don't want to have a lightning strike against
it. It can trigger lightning. If there's any inclement weather around, it will attract possibly a lightning bolt.
Exactly so.
Well, tell me the physics of that.
Well, as it goes up, it leaves what we call an ionization trail, and that can help get the lightning started. Plus, it's a big, long metal thing, and pointy metal things generally attract lightning, just as if you look at a lightning rod, that's what it is. It's a long rod. And so with that combination of things, they have a whole set of criteria about what they're allowed to launch into, and we did not meet those for two or three different ways.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Tell us now about this mission, the NASA Radiation Belt Storm Probes Project. You are a principal investigator for part of that project. Describe the mission as a whole.
Well, the idea here is to go back to the radiation belts. It's sort of an interesting story, of course, as people in Iowa know. Van Allen discovered this back in 1958, actually 2 days before I was born, as it turns out. And people flew various missions early on, and people thought we had a pretty good idea. The scientists working on this had looked at the data, and they thought they had models that were fairly good in predicting things. And by the early 80s, let's say, when I was a graduate student, it looked like, you know, the experts would talk about details, but that was pretty much the story, and people thought we had it. We often joke that the book had been written, because, in fact, there is a textbook on the subject. And then the early 90s, a couple of missions went up that showed that the radiation belts were a little more complicated than we thought. Unfortunately, those satellites were very incomplete sets of measurements, so they were sort of tantalizing.
Mm-hmm. Were the misunderstandings that were discovered something that we can understand without a physics degree?
Sure. Really what it came down to was it was much more variable and dynamic than people had realized. New belts would appear, the outer radiation belt would change, get larger, get smaller, and quite complicated too, because we would look at the kinds of things that might drive it, and you could find roughly the same signature, and you would get three different kinds of responses. They'd pump up, they'd get smaller, or nothing would happen. And so that was a real puzzler. And so that led to people proposing that we really ought to go back and measure this properly. Mm-hmm. The other very exciting thing is this will be the first time that we have two satellites. And that lets us figure out, you know, if something's happening here, is it happening over there? Does it follow it? Does it precede it?
They won't be orbiting close to each other?
Well, they start off together, but the orbits are just slightly different. Not enough so as you notice, except for the fact that when they're different like that, one satellite runs ahead of the other. And so every 73 days, it laps the other satellite. So they gradually separate. And this is the way we get lots of different distances between them so we can compare different phenomena and see what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we back up a little bit and have you explain a little bit more fundamentally what the radiation belts are, the Van Allen radiation belts are. What are they? Why do they exist? What purpose do they serve?
Well, they're a natural phenomena around the Earth. We often think about radiation as, you know, gamma rays or X-rays. Well, that's one kind of radiation. That's electromagnetic radiation. But there's another kind, which is particle radiation. And so what these are particles that are very energetic or very fast, you might think of it. In fact, they move very close to the speed of light, and that makes them relativistic. But what that also means is they have so much energy that they can punch right through metal and have damaged satellites in the past and things of that character. And what they are is they're trapped by the Earth's magnetic field. So when particles get pushed into here and energized, they can't escape, and so they build up. And it turns out every magnetized planet that we know of in our solar system has a radiation belt.
Okay. If you have questions about the radiation, the Van Allen radiation belts, which will be investigated by this new project, join our conversation with Craig Kletzing, a University of Iowa physics and astronomy professor, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, or email, tweet us at IPR Talk, or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Okay, so we have these belts, these radiation belts up there, much more complicated than we originally thought after James Van Allen discovered them in 1958. How do they affect us here on Earth?
Well, there's quite a number of systems that we use now that depend upon what we often call our assets in space. So, for instance, people are quite familiar these days with using GPS. In fact, I often joke, does anybody know how to use a map anymore? Well, GPS satellites are in space, and so we want to understand how to build satellites that can last and put up with this very, very harsh environment. Communication satellites, all of the TV that you see, the feeds typically come through a satellite out of what we call geosynchronous orbit, which is right in the heart of the outer radiation belt. And there are other examples of this kind of phenomena that we call space weather. For instance, the aurora borealis are a visible example that we see on the surface of the Earth. But space weather can also influence power systems. They've blown up transformers when we have big surges of power from the sun. So there's a lot of things in our technological society that are affected by space weather. And we want to understand, ideally, to the level we could start to predict in advance what's going to happen. We have a ways to go to get there, but that's the goal.
Mm-hmm. So what for you or for this project are the greatest unknown questions?
I think the biggest unknown question for us is, what are the processes that actually cause the radiation belts to pump up, cause the radiation belts to decrease? And it seems, from what we can tell at this point anyway, that it's a very careful balancing act between those two things. Things that make them bigger, things that make them smaller. And it's getting at the actual physics of these kinds of processes, which we think largely is caused by various kinds of waves, that we want to understand.
Mm-hmm. And these instruments, the instruments created by you and the University of Iowa researchers, will help us better predict what's going on with these radiation belts?
That's the goal. We have a set of instruments that measure the electric and magnetic fields that the spacecraft will see as it flies through them. And that set of instruments is crucial. We see both very low-frequency things. There are some waves that are measured in minutes in terms of how long they oscillate, up to things up to 12, 13 kilohertz or so. And our experiment here at the University of Iowa measures those kinds of wave signatures.
Mm-hmm. How big is the instrument made at the University of Iowa for this project?
Well, there are three key parts. There are two sensors, one which is quite small, maybe the size of three cell phones stacked on top of each other. That's what we call our DC magnetometer. There's a search coil magnetometer, which is looks like three sticks, oh, maybe an inch in diameter and about 8 or 9 inches long or so, and they're mounted at right angles to each other. Those two sensors sit on the ends of booms. So one of the first events that we're anticipating excitement is when we deploy those booms, because we turn on just before that, and then we'll see them as they go out by measuring the field. You see the variation as they go out. Then we have a central box that we call our main electronics box that houses all the electronics. And that's the size of maybe a couple of bread boxes, you might say, but very well shielded.
Mm-hmm. And so how long after launch will this boom go out with those instruments on it?
Those booms go out just about 15 hours after launch. And so we are actually the first experiment that gets turned on among the instruments on the spacecraft because we want to see that deployment take place. So once we launch, I'll go back and sleep for a few hours and get back up and go out to where we have what we call our ground support equipment, which allows us to look at these signals coming back and look for that first set of signals.
Mm-hmm. And what will those first set of signals be? Sort of a hello from the instrument?
So to speak. Our instrument pretty much turns on and boots up, takes about a minute or so to do that, and data starts to flow. And very shortly thereafter, we have about 15 minutes to check out, and then the spacecraft says, okay, deploy the booms. Mm-hmm. And off they go. And that'll be quite an exciting signature because the sensors are moving during that time, and so we'll see the variations in what they're measuring as they move.
You're calling this space weather in space. How much is it like or unlike the weather we have here on Earth, or above the Earth, I guess it is, that we experience in the atmosphere?
Well, in some sense, it's fundamentally different because in space we don't have gases and moisture like you do on the planet. We have what we call a plasma there, but we have a lot of phenomena that we use analogies with. For instance, we have storms. We have precipitation that we talk about. So some of the same kinds of ideas. But it's a good way to visualize what's going on, that there's actually quite a bit of stuff going on, various kinds of phenomena that affect us. And so space weather has become a nice term to use to help explain people what it is we study.
Mm-hmm. How big is the team at the University of Iowa working on part of this NASA Radiation Belt Storm Probes project?
I don't have an exact count, but I'd say we're about 15, 16 people at this point. That's all the folks that help us build up and test, as well as the programmers that help us analyze the data and turn what comes back into a usable scientific quantity that we can use to study.
Mm-hmm. So once the satellites are deployed, the instrument goes out on its boom, starts sending back data. There is a team here that will be receiving the data stream?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the part we look forward to. We've been building this for 6 years now, so we really want to get that data. But we have a broader team than that. We also have colleagues that are part of our investigation at the University of New Hampshire. There's colleagues at the Goddard Space Flight Center. And then we have colleagues at UCLA and Los Alamos National Laboratory. So we have a team that's spread across these various institutions, and we will all be studying the data together.
Mm-hmm. Other universities are involved in this too, as well, not just the University of Iowa. You have other colleagues you're working with?
Right. So what I just described is our specific investigation, mm-hmm. but there are teams from the University of New Hampshire that have alliances with the University of Colorado, the Aerospace Corporation out in California, as well as Los Alamos National Laboratory and Southwest Research Institute. There's another collaboration between the New Jersey Institute of Technology and the Applied Physics Lab at Johns Hopkins University. Just to name a couple of the other investigations. And there's one other that's Minnesota, University of Minnesota, and University of California at Berkeley.
Mm-hmm. When you make an instrument like this that you hope will function how long on this satellite? How many years?
We designed for what we call the two-year mission lifetime. But typically, we design to absolutely make sure it will run for that period of time. And that usually means that it will last for quite a bit longer than that. But NASA missions of this size, typically, that's the requirement. You design to make sure it lasts for 2 years. But we are so well shielded, I expect that we'll go for a few years beyond that.
Mm-hmm. So what type of temperatures and forces does an instrument have to be able to withstand?
Well, we have to withstand everything in the launch, and that's probably one of the harsher environments. The rocket, as it goes up, is very noisy, and it shakes rather violently, actually, and so we test everything. We expose it to that same noise environment. We shake it. We actually take all the instruments and put them in a vacuum chamber and pump them down and then take them through the temperature extremes that they're going to see. So one of the things to make sure it works is we just test, test, test.
Mm. Okay, let's talk to Stephen. Stephen, calling from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Stephen. Thanks for tuning in to Iowa Public Radio. What's on your mind?
Hi, I just had a question about the actual particle radiation. Where are these supercharged particles coming from that are getting trapped in the atmosphere?
Well, that's actually one of the questions we're interested in understanding. We know part of it comes in from a little bit further out, input from the sun. But we also think what happens is we can take lower energy particles and these waves can occur and then they pump energy into them to pump these particles up. And suddenly you have a much bigger radiation belt than you had before. But that's one of the central goals of our mission is to understand exactly what you're asking.
Back to the survivability of these instruments, it will be a launch, hopefully on Thursday, to launch these two satellites aboard this Atlas V. But we had a successful landing of many instruments on the planet Mars just a few days ago. That has to withstand much more. I'm wondering about your reaction to that landing and the degree of difficulty in that project compared to your project?
Well, for both missions, we have to survive exactly the same launch criteria because they were also launched on an Atlas V. However, they have to deal with the landing, and that's much more complicated. And what I think makes it particularly complicated is they have to do all this essentially on remote control at another planet. They're far enough away that you can't really command in real time to try to tell it what to do. So everything has to be pre-programmed and go off just as you expect it. That's not something that we have to worry about because we're next to the Earth, and so we can communicate with the satellite quite quickly if we need to.
Okay. Craig Kletzing is my guest for this first half hour, University of Iowa Physics and Astronomy Professor, Principal Investigator for part of the NASA Radiation Belt Storm Probes Project that has had two attempts at launches on Friday and on Saturday. They were called off for two different reasons. Hopefully, when Tropical Storm Isaac passes, they will get the green light to launch Thursday morning, you said, right, Craig?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 4:05 in the morning, Eastern time. So if you're here in Iowa, you don't have to get up quite as late. You can get up a little bit earlier at, 3 o'clock in the morning.
Can we somehow experience it here? No.
Oh, absolutely. NASA has a feed. You can go to the NASA website, and they will have this all on NASA TV, and you can hear the countdown and watch the launch go off.
Okay, very good. You will be in Florida again. Tell me a little bit, Craig Kletzing, about how you became a physicist. You became interested in this. Can you trace it back to a boyhood experience?
Well, certainly I'm the right age group to have been a big fan of the space program when I was a kid. I remember when John Glenn went into orbit and the various Gemini satellite spacecraft going up. And that was all very exciting. And, of course, culminating in the landing on the moon, that was, a tremendous event and still remains a tremendous event. When you think about the complexity of that and how long ago we did it, more than 40 years ago, that's really quite astounding.
It is.
That we were able to do it. And then, going into junior high and things, I was always interested in physics. I used to like to read a lot of science fiction. I think somewhere along the way I decided, well, if any of this was going to happen, I was going to really need to get a physics degree. And so when I went to UC Berkeley, I decided to be a physics major, although actually I was on a theater arts scholarship my first year, so I waited till that was up with, and then
I declared physics. That's
a
quite
major.
A stretch. Dave on our Facebook page asks, to what extent solar activity space weather impact our climate on Earth?
Well, that's actually an active topic. It's not really my area of expertise, but there are starting to be people now that are quite interested in this coupling between solar activity, space weather, and how it affects things on the Earth. It's really sort of become a topic of serious study maybe in the last 5 to 10 years or so. Mm-hmm. And certainly our measurements on the radiation belt storm probes will feed into that. The experts that work on this kind of thing have to know more about, let's say, specifically atmospheric physics versus space physics, which is my specialty, and how those two things couple together.
Mm-hmm. Of course, a few days ago, we had the passing of the first man to stand on the moon. Neil Armstrong died. We talked about the 1960s launches, the missions then that inspired you to do what you're doing today, Craig Kletzing. I wonder if you have a sense or can relay a sense of how the technology used, for example, in 1969 to put Neil Armstrong on the moon compares with our technology today.
Well, we've come a little way since then. You have to remember in 1969, integrated circuits had just barely become available. Transistors were certainly around, but the kinds of things we do today are way, way, way beyond that. These days, the cell phone that you carry around has more computing power than the computers they were using to figure out orbits and things like that at NASA.
Really?
The technology of the electronics has just advanced tremendously, so that really it's almost unimaginable how far we've come in the last 40 years or so.
You've received several teaching awards, I see, and I'm wondering how you make class interesting in this area, how you what you've learned about grabbing the attention, holding the attention of students who could potentially be future researchers such as yourself.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think the most important thing is actually just to be enthusiastic about the material that you're teaching. But I do bring in some of what we do. Several years ago, we had a sounding rocket that we were launching from Alaska, and I told the class about this, that I would be gone for a week because I had to go up and launch. And then I came back and said, well, no, we didn't launch, but I would let them know when we did. And when I did, we had a failure of the attitude control system on the rocket. And I said, well, you know, when we get a little further along, when we get to the rotational dynamics part of the class, I'll explain exactly why, with it spinning too fast, that we had problems. And I was kind of surprised. Two or three students came up afterwards and said, you know, you really are going to tell us, aren't you? They didn't want me to forget about that.
Leave them hanging.
And so I did explain it. And those kinds of things that often we don't bring our research directly, but the stories about what we're doing is always of interest to students.
It sounds like you must get the sense that you are inspiring a new generation through your involvement in this project and the way you can bring that into the classroom.
Well, getting to have young minds and explain things to them and see that moment when they're understanding things, they're asking a question, you finally help them get over the hump of understanding, that's a reward in itself that is really... Every teacher enjoys that, and that's the best part about teaching.
Maybe James Van Allen, who taught at the University of Iowa, inspired you. Were you here at the time he was here?
Yeah, we overlapped for about 5 or 6 years or so, and he and I often chatted about things. In fact, one time I was teaching the introductory astronomy course, and I was looking around for some books on problems and things like that and found one of the local bookstores. And you know, I started using it, and then he came down to my office about 2 weeks later and said, oh, you might want to use this book. And I showed him, I already have it, and he had some problems that he had written.
Oh, fabulous. Craig Kletzing, thank you very much for joining us this first half hour. University of Iowa physics and astronomy professor. We'll keep our fingers crossed for Thursday and the launch of this mission after Tropical Storm Isaac has cleared the path for that. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you. As we like to say, go Atlas, go Centaur, go RBSP.
All right. Coming up in just a moment, when we go launch, relaunch, after a short break, the director of the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication, David Perlmutter, tells us about his recent trip to Turkey. When we return, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. Wonderful to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, Frank Mink will join us. Frank Mink became a skinhead when he was just 13 years old. He roamed the country as an Aryan leader, neo-Nazi recruiter, with gangs that would beat people indiscriminately. Then came a prison term. Now, he's a civil rights activist. Tomorrow on this program, I'll talk with Frank Mink and filmmaker Christian Day, who is documenting Mink's journey throughout Iowa as he searches for his spirituality. The country of Turkey figures into much of our news, news in Europe, in Asia, the Middle East. In June, a group of University of Iowa professors and local media professionals took a trip to Turkey, their goal to further relationships with educational institutions and media entities in that country. Joining me now to tell us a little bit more about that trip, the man who led it, David Perlmutter. He is the director of the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Welcome back to our studio, David.
Thank you, Ben. Always good to be here.
Tell us a little more about the goal of this trip. Took place in June. What did you set out to do? How big was your group?
Well, we had about 10 people from Iowa, along with three guides who were graduate students, Turkish graduate students at the University of Iowa. And we traveled to about four or five cities in Turkey, including the capital, the main city of Istanbul, and then a little bit to the southeast, Izmir, and some then to the central Turkey and Cappadocia. Mm-hmm. And we visited Turkish colleges, universities, news organizations, other kinds of media organizations, and also some ordinary people who hosted us in their homes, and some political and media leaders as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's focus on two aspects of it, the educational institutions and the media entities. Let's focus on the media entities that you you visited there. First, can you give us an idea of how Turkey's media are different than ours?
Well, actually, you'll find more similarities than differences, but the media climate there is somewhat different. For example, Turkey is a country that has recently spent a lot of money educating its citizens, so widespread literacy is rather new. So one consequence of that is that the news industry that is challenged here in many ways is booming there. I mean, we visited this one newspaper that's its circulation within the last decade had increased from 100,000 to 1 million.
That's quite a jump.
That's right. I mean, the Turks are still interested in reading newspapers. They're innovating a lot of things which are sort of we're used to, you know, types of channels, you know, cooking. We visited a cooking show, for example, and you know, we're pretty much full of cooking shows here in the United States, and you're trying to think of what new variation of a cooking show there are. Well, cooking shows are not they haven't been doing those for 30 years in Turkey. So there are a lot of things that are popular because they just hadn't been on Turkish television or in Turkish newspaper or magazine markets before. So we saw a really incredibly entrepreneurially guided media there, new startups, new ventures, new conglomerations all the time.
Mm-hmm. Going back to newspapers, so where are they? As you mentioned, the troubles faced by newspapers in this country now for several years, the printed newspaper subscriptions declining there. They're not facing the same sort of challenges?
They're aware of what's going on around the world. So for example, the editor of the newspaper that I just mentioned, which had this incredible rise in circulation, was trying all sorts of experiments with digital media. He said, look, we know we're going to eventually face the same challenges as American media. We're watching you. We want to learn from what American news organizations do to deal with these issues. But we know we've got maybe a 10-15 year window to solve these issues before we face them with the same problems that you and America have.
And so until they all the Turks have their iPads and tablets loaded up with all the apps.
Well, you know, 18-year-olds are the same all over the world, as you've seen. Mm-hmm. They're one unified species. So everybody there was talking about their daughter is text messaging all the time, and she won't watch television. She just wants to watch things on their mobile phones. So they are aware that the new generation coming up are going to have different demands on media than the fathers and the mothers.
You can join our conversation this half hour as we talk with David Perlmutter, director of the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication, talking about media and education in Turkey. He led a group in June to visit several places in Turkey and to exchange ideas and to build relationships with educational and institutions and media entities. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk. You mentioned they will be watching us. They are watching the United States, media landscape, Western Europe, also at the forefront of the digital age here. Were you asked the question, what is the business model for thriving journalism in a digital age?
Yes, I was asked. I don't have the answer. I don't think anybody has the answer, and they don't have the answer either. But I think everybody agrees that the exploration for the answer is a very crucial one. And the other thing that you notice there is that they also understand that it's not one answer. I mean, it isn't like there's going to be one revenue source which will deal with every kind of media out there. The challenges of, say, a daily newspaper are different than the challenges of a cable network or something, and there may be different solutions for each one.
Mm-hmm. Parts of an answer, many answers. Do we know any pieces of the puzzle right now? Can we state anything that we've learned in the last 5 years about the new business model?
Sure. Well, actually, the answer in Turkey that's emerging is pretty much the answer that's here that's emerging. It's not good news for everybody. And one is people, I say that knowing that the 18-year-old and, say, you and I are making our purchasing decisions somewhat differently. People will pay for premium content that they want, need, and can't get somewhere else. So, for example, hyper-local, local papers, in small towns in Iowa, are still doing very well, especially if they haven't racked up some big debt, which they usually haven't, especially if they're owned by a local family or a regional chain. Because, where else are you going to go for the news about the high school football team? It's not like there's 100 microbloggers competing with you for that. Or business news or specialty news about hobbies and crafts. People are willing to pay for that content. Audiobooks, we forget that newspapers used to be the place where Dickens was serialized. And so, people are willing to pay for books. They're willing to pay for other kinds of content that's premium. Great. The question is whether they're willing to pay for general news, sewer main break on 3rd Street on Thursday, and here's the latest fighting in Syria. Nobody's found a solution for that one yet. And so that's the real challenge about whether you can keep premium revenue to pay for the other one, or some places just give up on general news and just do premium content.
Mm-hmm. Why Turkey? Why was Turkey the destination and not any number of other countries?
Well, simply we were invited by a Turkish group, an association of Turkish foundations that do about 55 trips like this a year all over the United States. And we were specifically invited by the Niagara Foundation, which is based in Chicago. And they've done trips like these for Iowa educators and especially legislators over the last dozen years or so. Turkey is also a fascinating country because its economy is booming. A lot of new things going. The Turks are opening 20 new public universities a year just to cope with the demand of their exploding high school population who want to go to college. They're opening entire private universities. And I'm not talking about the non-for-profits we're used to, like Kaplan and Phoenix. We're talking about actual, real, big universities with buildings where heavy research is going on, plus teaching. Fascinating place. And, of course, Turkey is really the crossroads of the future of the Middle East and Near East. Syria is a next-door neighbor. All of the troubles that are going on in that part of the world, Turkey is right in the middle of it. So it's a very interesting place to go and learn.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about some of the highlights you had, personal highlights on the trip.
Well, as I said, we got to visit people who ran news organizations. We got to visit the chief rabbi of Turkey. But we also got to visit ordinary people, people who owned a farm or were a medical doctor who hosted us at their house for dinner or for lunch. And by the way, one other reason to travel to Turkey is you will never have a bad meal in Turkey. So we got to meet some just fascinating people who were doing things at the local level. What we really came away with, so our general impression, was that how really interested everyone we met was with building good relationships with the United States. We have a sort of bipolar view of the world of either they hate us or they love us. But in between, there are people who we disagree with what America did here and this, but we really want to be friends and let's learn more about each other. So there's something in between hate and love.
So in your area, in media and education about the media, what were their specific interests in you? Why does the Niagara Foundation have groups like yours come over? What do they hope to get out of it?
Well, their purpose, their mission is to have as many people exposed to modern Turkey as possible. They want people to learn about Turkey and to build those kinds of friendships and relationships. That's what they do.
Okay. David Perlmutter with us, director of the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication, recently back along with other members of a group from a trip to Turkey to further relationships with educational institutions there, also media entities in that country. I understand that, of course, Turkey and Greece have long been rivals. They fought many wars with each other, have disputes. And I understand that you are yourself a Greek, and in fact, your grandfather fought in several wars with Turkey. That must have been an interesting perspective for you.
Yes, and it made it a personal journey as well as a professional one for myself. My mother is Greek Orthodox Christian, and as far as I can tell, I'm the first male member of that branch of the faculty that has not been in the military and not personally fought in a war with Turkey so far.
Right.
I've always told the Turks, so far, I don't know what the future
Remind
will bring.
Us a little bit about the disputes between Turkey and Greece.
What is now Anatolia, the region of Anatolia, was mostly lived in for thousands of years by Greeks, Greek-speaking peoples, and was part of, for example, the Empire of Byzantium. And the Turks defeated Byzantium and conquered that territory and occupied Greece or ruled over Greece, depending on who's doing the telling of it, for about 500 years. And the Greeks revolted, broke off, formed their own country, which exists today as Greece, as did all the Balkan states, which were part of this Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was broke when it fell. It broke up into, I believe, either 31 or 32 countries, to tell you how large it was. And, there's been enmity and war pretty much for about 600 years. And, if you come from the Balkans, 600 years ago is yesterday. Americans think back to the Civil War, and maybe we sort of, especially in the South, you may remember the Battle of Antietam. But you go to certain places in the eastern part of the world, and they're mad about what happened 700 years ago. So,
You said this, the idea behind the people who invited you was for you to glimpse modern Turkey.
Right.
So did you or any others in your group get some myths busted or misconceptions reoriented to what is modern Turkey and what we may get is in a skewed view, a not altogether accurate view from our media about Turkey?
You go to Turkey and you see the amazing archaeological ruins and remains of 10,000 years of civilization. But you also see the sky cranes all over the cities and the huge building. But one encounter I think was the most telling for me. We had a fantastic breakfast at a farmhouse, and the grandfather, the father of the owner there, had lived in Crete after the last war between the Greek the one that was in the 20s, where grandfather fought in. There was what was called a population transfer, which was basically a lot of Turks were expelled from Greek territories and a lot more Greeks were expelled from Turkish territories. He was the son of one of the people expelled in that. And he and I were talking about how between peoples, there's nothing left to fight over. Yeah, governments and politics might always create something, but it was a sort of personal sense from me that as long as we can get peoples together as much as possible, we might actually have some peace in this world.
Mm-hmm. And did you get a sense of what they were surprised about concerning you as an American, your group, perhaps some preconceived notions that didn't hold up when they got to know you?
If you talk to any of our students who come from other countries, they have the usual stereotypes. Americans are all rich and fat and paved with gold. So, I disabuse them of one of those. not sure about the other one. But I actually, they knew a lot about us, partly because for these trips, they've done research on who will be visiting, and they've met Americans coming through before. So I think the Turks have fewer stereotypes about us than we have about them.
Of course, looking at the media entities, connecting with several media entities in Turkey, I know you're not an expert in geopolitics in Turkey, but through their media, what sense did you get of the major political issues they face that's on their minds these days? Syria has to be at the top of that list.
Yeah, well, there's a whole series of issues. First, they have the continuing issues with the Kurdish minority that's in eastern Turkey. And every day you would read about Turkish soldiers killed, Kurdish insurgents killed. So, I mean, there's a continuing, essentially, civil war and very big guerrilla war going on in eastern Turkey that is a headline practically every other day. And yes, while we were there, Syria shot down a Turkish jet fighter. So that was obviously huge news. And yeah, they're having a massive violent civil war, killing 1,000 people right on their doorstep, having a huge refugee problem. So Syria is right there in the middle of it in many ways. I'm sorry, Turkey. And so was it fascinating to talk to these people who are covering these stories.
Mm-hmm. Both Muslim nations, but different sorts of Muslim nations.
Yes. You also learn about the diversity. You know, the term Islam covers billions of people, but there are many different groups within that. And you sort of learn about some of the complexities of who belongs to what group more than another, and different doctrines and outlooks on the world.
Mm-hmm. Did you get a sense through their media of how they view the United States as a NATO ally? Turkey, also in NATO, not in the EU. Greece is in the EU, but not Turkey.
I think you find a lot of variation there because Turkish newspapers are sometimes aligned with political parties, and there are political parties there which are more get along with the West oriented, than there some are more antagonistic. So you saw a wide variation, and for at least the English language ones are the ones which are translated. You saw the same news story related to the United States covered wildly differently. So I think that shows the health of their news media, that they have such pluralism in opinions.
Mm-hmm. Do they have a partisan media, or do they have this idea of objectivity, which at least in the past we've been striving for here in our tradition of journalism?
I think you see a mixture of the two there. We had a fascinating talk with the editor of a newspaper where he said that he wants to get the facts right, but he wants his readers to be educated about what they should do about those facts, which some people could interpret as a partisan slant. But he saw, for example, himself as an educator of his readers. You can take that as you will.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What do you see in the future relationship of the University of Iowa and Turkey, or any of the entities that you visited there? What are you hoping to build there in the future?
Well, I see contacts between the journalism and communication schools, because they're building more of them every day there to feed this giant industry that is being created. I think they're interested in our students. They're into professor exchanges, professional exchanges. I predict within the next 5 years you're going to see some of those. On the level of the actual professionals, I think they're very interested in, again, how the American news media is coping with all the big changes that they know they're going to have to face very soon as well.
Mm-hmm. So do you hope to have some exchange students, Turkish students, going to the University of Iowa School of Journalism?
Yes. I predict we're going to have more and more Turkish students coming, because their university system cannot absorb all their fantastic and English-speaking students that they're graduating.
Mm-hmm. Now, what did you find out was known about Iowa or its people when you put out your censors and kind of felt around about what they knew about those four letters?
Well, as you might imagine, the rest of the world associates basically two things with Iowa. One is an animal, and one is a vegetable product. So they were fascinated to hear about all the other things that go on in Iowa. They'd heard about the University of Iowa, which is, I think, our prestige carries across. And there were a lot of people who'd known graduates, because we, especially in engineering and medicine, had quite a number of people of Turkish descent who'd gone through, and the sciences. We've quite a number of Turkish graduate students here in the sciences. So we weren't a complete blank spot on the map.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah. There was a running joke that Turkey is the Iowa of the Middle East, you know, as this sort of island of sort of normality and stability in a very topsy-turvy and unstable area. The Turks are the Midwesterners of the Middle East and Near East and Balkans. I think that was a nice way to put it.
That is a nice way to put it. Does Turkey have a sister city, Iowa and Turkey? Do they share?
Don't know.
Maybe that's something to explore too. Did you find? We have just a minute or so left. Did you discover a favorite Turkish food that you hadn't
latched onto before?
Oh, I think all of them were. there was nothing I turned down.
Okay.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
At the journalism school, this semester is just getting underway. Anything at the journalism school you want to know before we say goodbye?
Oh, it's an exciting time. There are a lot of new areas of journalism and communications being developed. This is the era of multimedia, multi-platform, so it's just every day is very exciting for the students to discover new things that they want to specialize in.
Mm-hmm. New students coming into journalism?
Yeah.
How are they different than students who came 10 or 15 years ago? What are they seeking that's different?
Well, I think that there's more of an understanding that, a career coming out of our school is not just two things, reporter or public relations agent, that there's now 1,000 different careers out there under the wide worlds of news and information and strategic communication. So the students are just have a much more varied interest than I think they would have had 20 years ago.
Okay. David Perlmutter, director of the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication, thank you for taking the time to come into our studio and tell us about your trip. Thank you.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Julie Englander. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.